Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In every generation, there have been doomsayers who have predicted the death of religion in the United States. Many of these prognostications rely upon observations that people are leaving their denomination, that denominations are losing their appeal among Americans, and that an influx of new religious groups, from Catholics in the 1800s to Hare Krishna in the 1960s, have peeled away traditional Protestants from their churches, leaving the future of Christianity in doubt. What is the real state of the religious landscape in America? How have the spiritual preferences and worship practices of Americans changed over the past two centuries? And can studying megatrends in the past help us understand where we might be headed in the near future? To assist us in better understanding America's changing religious landscape, I am joined today by J. Gordon Melton, the founder and director of the Institute for the Study of American Religion, located in sunny Santa Barbara, California, where he has published over 400 articles and commentaries, as well as 8 editions of the popular and incredibly useful Melton's Encyclopedia of American Religions. Dr. Melton, who is an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church, is also a distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. Given that Baylor is the world's largest Baptist university and that Gordon Melton is a practicing Methodist, suffice it to say that the spirit of ecumenism is alive and well today between Waco and Santa Barbara. Gordon, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good to be here.
I'm particularly excited to have Dr. Melton on the podcast today because of his literally encyclopedic knowledge of how American religiosity has changed over the course of several centuries. Given that our show discusses a number of topics related to religion in the United States, I feel this podcast can become an anchor point for many discussions to follow, and that our listeners will be able to use this particular episode as a way of reviewing the religious history in America. But before we begin our survey of American religiosity, though, I'd like to get a bit of background on you so that folks can appreciate the amazing effort you've put forth in documenting the who, the what, the where, when, and why of our religious history. You founded the Institute for the Study of American Religion, also known as ISAR, in Evanston, Illinois back in 1968. Is that correct?
That's correct. I and a group of fellow grad students, I was in Northwestern University at the time, put the original board together, and we've been going strong ever since.
Now, what was your motivation for doing this at the time? This is 1968 Chicago. You know, had the Chicago trials there and riots during the Democratic convention. So it's a very turbulent time. One wouldn't think that anybody would be studying religion at this time.
Well, part of the turbulence was a turbulent religious scene as well. But there were two primary motivations. Number one is that I had at that point developed a list of a whole bunch of religious groups in America that no one was really looking at, and thought that it was important to do it, and that looked like very good virgin territory for a young PhD student. I was also concerned about a particular set of groups, the ones that we had come to call esoteric groups. Back then we called them the occult, mm-hmm. which nobody was studying, nobody had studied, no one had even gathered up the material so that you could study it. So we founded the Institute with those two ideas in mind, that we wanted to put together a collection of material so that future generations could study the occult, and which has become a very important part of academia now, and then also that we could look at all of these groups, many of which were Christian denominations, that no one else was looking at in any kind of holistic way.
Mm-hmm. Now, how has the Institute changed over the years? And you obviously moved from Illinois out to sunny California.
Well, we've sort of changed as generations came and went. We first of all developed an interest in Canada. So we enlarged our realm of study that way. And then as I began to travel more internationally, we began to realize how many new groups were coming in from overseas that we had not seen. So we began to develop an interest in other parts of the world. It became a resource for us in locating new groups. Mm-hmm. Large groups in other countries almost always had an American affiliate that we were able to track down, primarily by encountering them overseas.
Well, that raises an interesting question, because you're talking about a number of esoteric groups or smaller Christian denominations and such. One of your most important tasks at ISAR has been documenting the numbers and names and the historical origins of a number of these groups. I mean, how do you go about doing something like that? How do you find these small groups in the nooks and crannies of America and elsewhere?
Every which way in the world. We do it by keeping up clipping services and watching for news items about them, by continually asking colleagues, have they run across any new groups.
Mm-hmm.
I travel quite a bit. I will get to a new city or one I haven't been at for a few years, and one of the first things I will do is read the Yellow Pages and see if there are any new groups that have popped up in the religious listings in the local Yellow Pages. Just any kind of ways you want to do it. And in tracking out the history of groups we know about, we learn about schisms within those groups that have produced new groups that haven't come on the radar screen. It's a little bit easier now with the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
Probably about 10 years ago, began to look at the Internet as a major source for locating groups and just surfing the Internet. And I have a couple of colleagues now who regularly, as they surf the Internet and find new groups, as we say, run across them while we're looking for something else.
Right.
We will now stop and make note of that. And I keep a running list of groups that are not in the encyclopedia. I already have 100 groups from our last edition.
And your last
go in the next one.
Your last edition was 2008?
We wrote it in 2008. It came out in January 2009.
Got it.
So it's less than 2 years old.
So 100 new groups that you've discovered since then. I'm fascinated by the fact that you would use the phone book. And when we think about this today, I'm sure many of our listeners are tech savvy because they're on the interweb here looking for the podcast. But to think about how to do this 20, 30 years ago, you know, the old phone book, just pick up the phone book and see who's listed there. It's just, you know, absolutely fascinating. It can be a great research tool, something sitting right in front of you.
Well, it is, and also you can go to the libraries, or you used to, not mm-hmm. as much anymore. You used to go to the libraries, and local libraries would have big telephone book banks.
Right.
And you could sit there and go through the Yellow Pages for a number of different metropolitan areas at your local library. So you can't do that much anymore because of the Internet. But
mm-hmm.
that was one productive area. There was a classification in the phone book. It's still there, just called religious organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And groups that didn't readily fit in denominational headings under churches at the time would often be listed there because they didn't know where to put them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd look for groups that had odd names and contact them and see what they were about.
I'm interested in that as well, too. I just like walking through the research process, and I do that with my students quite a bit because we can provide a, you know, textbook image of what methodology is all about, but the actual footwork is kind of interesting. So you find one of these groups in the Yellow Pages, and you call them up, and what are you asking them?
We ask them what they're about, where they came from. We ask them to send us some of their material. If they have a newsletter, letter, or periodical, we ask them to put us on their mailing list. And many of them did. At one point, we were receiving as many as 500-600 periodicals regularly from the different groups. That was one of the things that was testing our ability to keep up facility-wise with all that we were accumulating.
Right.
And we would ask them if anyone had written a description history of the group, could they send that to us? Then I made a note of where their headquarters was, and as I traveled around the country, when I'd go to a city, I would go visit the headquarters of different groups that were there that we didn't have much information on, and try to accumulate copies of their theology books or their history books, biographies of founders, those kinds of things.
Most people been cooperative in these efforts, or have you run into any kind of unusual roadblocks or stories that were...
Overwhelmingly, 99% were very cooperative with us. Sometimes they grilled us as to where we were coming from. We had groups that had been burned in the past by people going in as researchers who really turned out to be polemicists against them.
Right.
Overall, there are a couple of separatist groups. In the 60s and 70s, there were a few black groups that didn't want to cooperate because I was white.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very few, and I can almost remember my encounters with them because they stand out in terms of walking up to the door of a black Muslim temple and having somebody open it 3 inches and say, go away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that, but they're very rare.
Okay. Well, you recently wrote a guiding paper that is posted at the Association of Religious Data Archives. We'll post a link to that paper. The ARDA, as it's known, is managed by Roger Finke of Penn State and Chris Bader of Baylor. The title of your essay is "Americans Religion." Give me the, let me get this straight here. "American Religion's Megatrends: Gleanings from 40 Years of Research." Now, if you had to pull out one of the most interesting and or important megatrends over the past 230 years of America life, what would that be?
Well, there are two kind of mirror image megatrends. One is the significant, tremendous growth that the Christian church has had through the 20th century to the present. The other is the seeming downplay of the unaffiliated people.
Mm-hmm.
That is that it's a number that's interesting because percentage wise the number of people not affiliated to a religious group has dropped from 65% to less than 20%. It's also interesting is that the absolute numbers is about the same. That is, at the beginning of the 20th century there were about 50 million people who weren't affiliated with anything. Nowadays, there are about 50 million people who fit in that unaffiliated category, but the 50 million makes a much, much smaller percentage of the population.
Yeah, we're much larger.
The number has remained about the same, but the percentage dwindles, and that's a very interesting figure.
I think that is absolutely fascinating, and a number of our listeners might not know that. There's often talk on the Christian radio stations and the Christian media that, oh, we're, you know, becoming a less and less religious nation where people are losing their affiliations. But, you know, as you have shown, not only from 1900, but even dating back to, you know, the colonial period, the revolutionary era of American life, the beginning of the 19th century, there weren't that many people who were affiliated with churches at all.
No, what we call the Second Great Awakening is really the churching of America. The people who came from Europe through the 19th century, but especially in the colonial era, were the European misfits.
Mm-hmm.
These were the people on the edge of society, on the edge of culture, on the edge of institutions. They were the people who had the least connections and the least to lose by leaving Europe. So they come here, they're still that same people. We have told the story of the people who came here for religious freedom, but they were a minuscule number of people relative to all the people that came to the United States. and the largest group that came here for religious freedom, and that's a real misnomer. They didn't come here for religious freedom. They came here for the freedom to have their own religious establishment. Most of them came for economic reasons, not for religious reasons. That is, the leaders had religious reasons, but the people who came for economic reasons.
Yeah, that's one of the points that I made in my most recent book on the origins of religious liberty here in the United States. And through that process, it was fascinating to find out that we weren't as religiously affiliated or connected as we would normally think in some of our literature, you know, especially through grade school and high school and such. And it makes perfect sense when you think about who would be most likely to emigrate from Europe. It's going to be, you know, some 17 to 25 year old single male. And if on any given Sunday here in the United States today, you look around, the one group you don't see much of are 17 to 25 year old single males. So
that's a change that has occurred, but it's a constant in terms of the that 17 to 25 age group is the most volatile group. That's the time. We now understand that people are making their life decisions. So for them, it's a very, very important time. But it's a time when they're free to make those decisions. As I tell people, I'm not free to change a lot of my life now.
Right.
You know, you got a mortgage, you got a wife, you have all these things, big decisions you've made, and you can't just walk away from them.
Right. No, that's true. I'm experiencing that as well here now, too. In terms of this decline in religious non-affiliation, or the flip side of the coin would be the increase in religious affiliation, you know, especially over the past century, since, say, 1900, what might be explaining some of this trend that you say the drop is from about 66-65% to about 15% people who consider themselves non-affiliated? What's going on there?
There are several things that are happening. One has to do with population growth. There's been a tremendous explosion of population since the beginning of the 19th century. We went from 75 million people to almost 300 by the end of the 20th century. Now, of course, we're over 300 million people. That has been where religious growth has happened. It's followed population growth. And a lot of the groups that have grown the most are groups with large families. So that's been a part of it. Roman Catholic groups have grown that way. The other thing has been immigration. Groups have changed in terms of who comes here. The image that we have of America as a religiously free place has attracted religious refugees to the country, and so we've had a lot of people bring religion in. And with the growth of non-English speaking immigrants, then the religious community has become a place where immigrants who arrive not particularly religious have found a home. And so non-Christian religions and religious groups that don't speak English, Armenian Christians, for example, have found the churches and temples to be places where they have community in a foreign land. So that's been a part of it. But there have been other things that have happened. Religious groups that were sectional have become national through the migration of their members and setting up churches in regions of the country where they were not previously very strong. That's been an amazing thing to watch. The Unitarians right now are going through that kind of growth spurt that's caused. They've been focused in New England, and they've had a real program in the past couple of decades to put up Unitarian churches in other parts of the country, and so all of a sudden they've had a big membership growth, and they're are now above 200,000 members, which is for them is quite a large group. The most spectacular thing that's happened has been the Southern Baptist, of course.
Right.
Is the Southern Baptist, Northern Baptist kind of had an agreement that they would stay out of the other part of the country. The Northern Baptist actually had a large Southern membership, but it was all African American.
Mm-hmm.
The Southern Baptist, after World War II, decided we're going to go to other parts of the country. The out-migration of Southerners, they already had a lot of congregations in different places, and so they've now saturated the rest of the country. The fact that they have saturated the rest of the country means they're going to stop growing, and they have already noticed that they have stopped growing in the way that they did in the past generation.
Although one
saturation thing.
Although I guess one could imagine with, you know, Baylor University's basketball team, you know, going to the Sweet 16 in the recent NCAA tournament, that should also lead to a spurt in Baptist membership, I guess.
I don't think it did any more than Oral Roberts University going.
Oh, that's
going
true.
To help to Pentecostals.
I just have to put a plug in for Baylor University, who's sponsoring our podcast here. So, you know, go Bears, or sick 'em Bears, as they say. One of the things you brought up as well, too, is that, you know, the saturation effect. And I'm just wondering, over the 20th century, our country has moved from being a pioneering nation in the 1800s, and even still people migrating west throughout the first half of the year. And I think of the great California migrations after World War II. To becoming a settled nation. And it seems that leads to a lot more church growth. As we mentioned before, people who are up and on the move don't necessarily affiliate with religion. They're the people that don't have strong roots in the community, which is why they're up and moving. So do you think that is part of what is going on?
It is. At the present time, the real growth of mainline Christianity is in suburbia, and particularly in new suburbs. The larger churches, the ones that are big enough to really plan the future, will plant churches in places where they know that new communities will be springing up. So they'll go out and buy a plot of land that's ready for development and put a church there. Nobody's there, and 5 years later, they have a 500-member congregation there.
Mm-hmm.
That's been the only way that mainline has grown, because they've long since saturated the country. And, you know, you have same phenomena happening over and over again, is looking for the new frontier for growth after you've saturated the old and settled areas.
Now, one thing we need to mention about the decline in the unaffiliateds, and this is before we move on to talk specifically about what's been happening within denominations, but when we talk about unaffiliated, we're not talking about the irreligious, are we?
They're included.
Okay.
The unaffiliated is such a mixed bag. It's a lot of people who just don't like to fill out forms,
mm-hmm.
either philosophically or just because they're too busy to. It includes a whole spectrum of people, from atheists to members of separatist groups, to agnostics, to people who are in between, moving from one group to another, to some people who are very deeply religious, but who have very loose ties to any particular group. A few people who are affiliated to two different groups that they're trying to choose between. So it's a very, very mixed bag. It includes a lot of young people who are temporarily away from religion while they make those big life decisions about career and family and how they're going to live their life. They will return to religion later on and be replaced by the next crop of the 18 to 25. And so it's a very, very mixed bag.
There was recently a survey done the American Religious Identification Survey that showed during the during the 1990s there was a fairly significant jump in the number of people declaring themselves unaffiliated, or and the term became somewhat conflated with other things, non-religious or irreligious, in the popular media. You know, we just had Brad Wright on the show recently talking about this as well, and he's seen a similar trend in the general social survey. And do you have any idea of what might be going on here in the 1990s? I think we saw a jump from 10% saying they're unaffiliated to 15, 16%.
I think in part it's has to do with the sanction that we have given to people to admit they're not affiliated.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, with the small numbers that we're talking about in terms of polling and how that particular survey is done, that some of that may be fluctuation in how questions are answered and the regular inexactness that polls have at the edges. That I think is part of it. As we sharpen up our understanding of the unaffiliated, and we find that many of the people who list themselves as unaffiliated are affiliated with groups we may not think of as high status groups.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll list themselves as unaffiliated rather than affiliated with some magical religious group that none of us have ever heard of. So there are all kinds of things about that unaffiliated category that are yet to be sorted out.
Right.
What the use that's being made of those surveys, though, are atheists trying to say that they are a growing minority.
And is that the case?
It's not altogether clear. Atheists, almost by definition, are unaffiliated, but the atheist groups have really grown mm-hmm. in the past 20 years. Organized atheism is big business now, so to speak. But still, the actual number of people who will admit to being atheist is quite small. So it's very difficult with the kind of numbers that we're talking about to document how much there's been a growth among people who actually are non-believers.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that most of the unaffiliated are simply people who are not right now concerned with the religious matters.
Let me switch gears a little bit here and move away from the unaffiliated to the issue of denominationalism in the United States. And there's been a great deal of change over the past 230-plus years of our history as a nation. Let's first set some definitional boundaries here. What constitutes a denomination, and why might they be so important in American religious history or religious history in general?
Well, a denomination are a group of people in a free society who affiliate around sharing a common heritage, common history, a common thought world, which we generally think of as theology, but that includes both conclusions and questions,
mm-hmm.
What conclusions are important, what questions are important, and who share a common way of acting, having answered some theological questions. So that denominations are the way you structure religion in a free society.
Mm-hmm.
And so in every country where you have freedom of religion, you have this spectrum of denominations, and it's not just Christian, but it's Jewish denominations. That was a new phenomenon in the Jewish world in the 19th century. You now have 100 Buddhist denominations in America. You have a whole bunch of Hindu denominations. Muslims are a little bit more fuzzy, but harder to document, but there are Muslim denominations out there as well, and so on.
That was one of the most fascinating things I found in your paper, as well as the trends, but just the fact that denominationalism is not a Protestant Christian phenomenon. If you had asked me, you know, a few months ago, denominationalism, Protestantism comes to mind. But as you mentioned, it's across the entire spectrum, and one could even see it within the Catholic Church with the differentiation between charismatic Catholics and, you know, traditional pre-Vatican II Catholics and such.
We have a whole spectrum in this country of Catholic denominations.
Mm-hmm.
But denominationalism got associated with Christianity because it was in Protestant Christian countries where religious freedom really first germinated.
Right.
So you get these groups who are denominated, who have a different name, in order to distinguish them, and the denomination comes with kind of naming one of their distinguishing characteristics or one of their distinguishing beliefs. But that, again, that's true across the board.
And that it just, you know, makes sense when you mention this now, that the freedom to do that, you know, religious freedom is so important to do that, and with so many, you know, differences of theological opinion and styles of worship and such, it just seems natural when you open that door of religious freedom, you're going to see this outburst of denominationalism in many different forms.
So you actually have it in Roman Catholic countries and have had it for a long time, except the Catholics found a way of channeling the denominational sectarian urges into religious orders.
Right. Right.
So in France in the 19th century, you had 200 new religious orders being founded, and those people in what would have been a freer country, where religious differentiation was a little more free, they would have founded new denominations, but instead that energy got channeled into order.
Let's talk a little bit about the denominations that we see here in the United States, In your paper, you go through a list of the major denominations here in the United States, and do you happen to have offhand, remember what the top 10 or so are?
Oh, you can sort of remember, of course, Roman Catholic, Southern Baptist, United Methodist are the top three.
Right.
Then you pick up the large Presbyterian group, the two large Lutherans, Evangelical Lutherans, and Missouri Synod. United Church of Christ, the Episcopal Church, most of them are groups you know, and then there are the kind of newer groups, the Bible Baptist, the several Pentecostal groups, the Assemblies of God, the unexpected one is the Church of God in Christ,
mm-hmm.
the Black Pentecostal group that jumped into the top 10 all of a sudden when they finally did a count back in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
Discovered there were 4 million of them. As it turns out, there are 23 groups, 23 denominations that have a million or more members.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this list, and it ranges from the top, the Roman Catholic Church at about 67.2 million, Southern Baptists have about 16.4 million, you see the United Methodist Church at 8.2 million. The Church of God in Christ, which you mentioned, you have listed at about 5.4 million. So that's quite high. And that ranges all the way down to a number of denominations that have a million or so members, the Christian churches and Churches of Christ, and as well as the Orthodox Church in America.
The Russian Orthodox and the Greek Orthodox are both on there. And they're the only two of the Orthodox churches. And then you... each of the major denominational families has one or two groups on that list.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there are the African-American groups, mm-hmm. the African Methodist and the three National Baptist groups, and there are three Methodist groups that are all African-American.
So your paper talks about that denominationalism is not on the wane. Is that correct?
Oh no! As I said, it is the way you structure groups in this society, and the number of denominations just consistently grows. Right now, the growth area for new denominations is primarily among Pentecostals, and that's where we see the new denominational growth the most. There are just a lot of small Pentecostal denominations, charismatic denominations mm-hmm. That have emerged over the past 20 years. And so in the actual numbers, that's where you get the most. But almost every religious family or denominational family has new members appear every few years.
And there's been a great deal of talk in the popular media about the decline of the mainline churches. Are we likely at any point in the near future, say 20, 30 years out, to see a decline in mainline denominations?
I think we'll still see a decline in some of them. The Methodists seem to have slowed and stopped their radical decline. That was the major group that had significant decline over the past generation, but that seems to have now stopped, and they've kind of reasserted their identity and have gotten a hold of ways of growth. The growing groups, with probably the exception of the Roman Catholics, they're going to slow down, and different groups will stop growing. It's very hard for a group that has saturated the country but is not yet big enough to have a real planning department mm-hmm. To show it where to go and grow. So among those groups, we're going to have some stagnation or even decline. But part of it depends upon population growth.
Right.
Because so much of the growth of religions in this country had to do with the continued population growth. Population continues growing. The older groups will continue to grow, and new groups will continue to appear. If population growth stagnates, then different groups will suffer. Overall, Christianity is going to continue to grow,
mm-hmm.
but which segments of Christianity grows will depend upon population growth and their ethic towards sheep stealing.
Mm-hmm.
All of the groups that have grown have not grown by converting unbelievers. They have grown by stealing members from other churches.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the kind of elephant in the room about church growth that nobody wants to talk about. You see, all of our missionary growth in the Middle East over the past century has been by sheep stealing. There's been no absolute growth in the number of Christians in the Middle East for a century. It's only been people changing labels so that Christians from one group become Christians of another group. And that is often the case here, is that when you poll the new churches and ask where the members come from, overwhelmingly, they were raised as Christians, but they left one Christian church and joined this one. Saddleback Church in Orange County, the famous mega church, Rick
right.
Warren's group, has 99% of his members were raised as Christians and just chose to leave their church and go to Saddleback because that seems to be the happening place.
Is there any particular flow that we see this sheep stealing away from certain denominations to other denominations or denominational groupings?
Well, the main pattern that we see is people from more liberal churches going to more conservative churches, and people from more staid groups going to churches that seem more exciting or spontaneous in their worship. That's the main thing. Conservative groups are much quicker to define liberal groups, more liberal groups, as not Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are targets for evangelism. And liberal groups now are ecumenical groups. The larger denominations all have ecumenical relations, and those ecumenical relations have dictated against sheep stealing. So Methodists don't steal from Lutherans, and Presbyterians don't steal from Episcopalians, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Pentecostals will take from anywhere. that's part of the pattern that you have. As ecumenical relationships develop, those patterns will change.
That's interesting to kind of think of ecumenical relations in ways of creating cartels to prevent further stealing of sheep in that regard. What about the issue of community church? Before I get to community churches, I want you to step back a second. And what do you mean by liberal churches and conservative churches? We might need a definition for our audience who are not familiar with those terms.
Well, liberal churches are those churches that have a broader spectrum of members within. By the time you get to third, fourth, fifth generation of members, your membership differentiates beyond the group of committed people that you started with. The more liberal churches are those who will allow a large range of theology within their group. The major group of Methodists, for example, are kind of committed to a conservative Methodist theology, but Methodists allow theological perspectives across the board to mm-hmm. exist within the church, and those are some of the extremes are the ones that often get most known. The more conservative churches have a much more conservative theological unanimity and will tend to drive out, particularly from their pastoral ranks, pastors who might deviate in theology from their stated norm.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real difference between them, is that allowance of a more liberal approach to theology. It's also the case that among the liberal churches, there are things that are kind of assumed now that are not yet assumed in the conservative churches, having to do with biblical criticism and kind of a loss of historical naivete,
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things that are there.
Yeah, so it is clear, and for me as a political scientist, when I hear the term liberal churches, conservative churches, I naturally gravitate toward political affiliations, but this is largely a theological tendency when we talk about liberal churches and conservative churches.
Well, one of the major issues that divides liberal and conservative churches has to do with social action.
Mm-hmm.
And what issues is it legitimate to engage in social action? All of the churches agree, both liberal and conservative, for example, that social action relative to alcohol abuse
mm-hmm.
Is a legitimate social action. What they don't agree upon is social action relative to the status and role of women, social action relative to homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Churches across the board, from the Missouri Synod to the Episcopal Church, all agreed about AIDS and mm-hmm. about, for example, the treatment of AIDS patients in their hospital. And we're very active in countering AIDS. Those same churches radically disagree over participation in Washington on questions about the status of homosexuals in general.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of that liberal conservative split. What issues do we speak on, mm-hmm. and what issues do we remain silent on?
Let me get back to the question that I wanted to talk about before, because it has a personal connection with me. But what about the move toward community or non-denominational churches recently? And the reason I bring this up is that in our small town out here in rural Washington, a church is going through a split with a denomination as we speak. And as a social scientist, it's really interesting to be watching this from the center of this split. It's moving from its affiliation with the Evangelical Methodist Church to becoming a community church, as it calls itself, a non-denominational. Do we see that happening throughout the United States, or is this just happening to me in my small town?
We see it happening, but it's a transition you need to follow to the next step.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very difficult to exist as a community church. You have all kinds of practical problems that you have to solve, and solving it on your own is difficult. There is, of course, now a denomination of community churches for whom being a community church is their one of their denominational criteria.
Mm-hmm.
In general, a group will split from a denomination but then associate with another denomination that they find more compatible. And so they go through a transition. They can exist for a little while as an independent, unaffiliated congregation, but then they have problems about where do I get my Sunday school material and how do I participate in the mission program, where do I get my next pastor. There are all kinds of practical questions that tend to drive groups to a denomination. And I've watched groups that we spotted back in the 60s as independent congregations, and over a period of time, almost all of them affiliated with somebody. There are a few that got big enough to where they could continue to exist as an independent congregation and prided themselves on that. If they got really big, they became a denomination unto themselves,
mm-hmm.
and started creating satellite churches.
This is in many ways very fascinating to think through this process, is that, you know, a denomination of community churches just seems like an oxymoron. But, I mean, this speaks to, you know, what we were talking about earlier, that denominationalism is the most logical, rational, efficient way of organizing denominations. And you talk about the sharing of vacation Bible school material and such, just as much better when you have multiple churches to share it with.
Well, it's also the case that community churches or community-based churches have to become liberal Protestant, just on a practical matter. Because by being community-based, it means they reflect the spectrum of their community.
Hmm.
And most communities, the spectrum runs from very liberal to very conservative. And so your definition of liberal church is that it has a spectrum of views allowed. And by definition, community churches then are driven to fellowship with other churches that also allow those spectrum of views.
Hmm.
If a church remains totally a conservative church, as one would expect a former evangelical Methodist church to be,
mm-hmm.
then it would be driven toward another conservative denomination.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to be something I have to be watching here, and I think I'm, you know, possibly fodder for some podcast here in the future going through this. What about the opposite end of the spectrum, it says small community churches, the big mega churches. Where are these coming from? What has been the trend line with the Saddlebacks, the Willows Creeks, over the past 20, 30 years?
Well, I take my remarks, first of all, from Ted Haggard's church.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that back in the days, Ted was put forth as the successful leader of a large independent mega church.
Right.
In fact, it was like Willow Creek. It was a large independent church that had become a denomination unto itself and had a whole bunch of satellite congregations. They were able to replace him when he fell in the pulpit within a week because they simply pulled the pastor from another one of the affiliated churches and put him in the big lead church.
Mm-hmm.
Of the denomination. Willow Creek is like that. It has actually several of its congregations are in Europe, but it is a denomination unto itself, and there are other Willow Creek congregations scattered across the United States. Mega churches are of three kinds. The majority of them are just big churches of a old denomination that has taken the denominational name off of the front door.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the great majority of mega churches are like Saddleback, which is Southern Baptist, and continue that way. And once you get to be a part of them, you understand their denominational affiliation, mm-hmm. and also why that name isn't there. Second, there are the mega churches that are denominations in mourning. That is, they've grown a big church. They've got 10,000 members. They're training pastors, and they're creating their own denomination. And that's something we see. A mega church will grow up around a charismatic leader, and once they fill the space, and usually around 7 to 10,000 is as much as you can handle in one space and one parking lot, then you start training pastors, and that's a normal thing to do. You train missionaries, you train pastors, you train lay leaders, and those pastors need a place to exercise their duties. You fill up the church staff at the lead church, and then you start forming new congregations, and you stay in affiliation with each other. There are a few churches that remain single, independent churches, but they are the rarest of the lot. And the crisis with them usually comes when their charismatic pastor dies or retires. And how do they replace him? Where do they replace him? Those kinds of issues come up. And that's usually when that congregation has to change status.
What would be an example of a church such as that?
Well, the Old People's Church in Chicago was one. Oswald Smith's church in Toronto was one, and I think continues to be, but a single congregation. They're just few and far between in that third category.
And what about the second category, too, the denominations in mourning? What would be some examples of those types of churches?
Haggard's Church, of course, was a major example of that.
What about Joel Osteen's?
Johnny Coleman's church on the south side of Chicago, Pearson, Carlton Pearson, is now pastor of. That was one such. And you've got a whole bunch of them among the Pentecostals. A lot of the Pentecostal denomination, big mega churches that grew up in Oklahoma City and Tulsa and Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston, those became new denominations. Fred Price's Crenshaw Christian Center in Los Angeles, that started out as a black branch of the faith movement churches that Kenneth Hagin had built up. Kenneth Hagin built them up. They've got 100 denominations that were built out of Ken Hagin's television ministry. And then Fred Price came out and started a black denomination that was the equivalent thereof. Many of the groups, the mega churches, are also built around a television preacher.
Right.
So that gives you an audience that lives in other places.
Have we seen? I'm curious about this phenomena. I mean, have we seen a growth in that? Are people who might say they're unaffiliated really watching the 700 Club, you know, in the afternoon?
Overwhelmingly, televised religion preaches to the people who are already members of churches. There's not a lot of people who are not already committed Christians who are watching religious television.
So in large part, it's a complement, not a supplement for
right.
The...
Yeah, it took a long time for most of the major denominations to look upon television as a helpful tool rather than as a competition. But there are people who have built their ministries off originally the radio and now television. You see this with Jerry Falwell.
Right.
Falwell goes out. He splits with the Bible Baptist. He forms the Thomas Road Church. He gets on television, and Thomas Road Church then grows into a big church, and now it's grown into a big denomination, 100 congregations affiliated. And that grew off of Falwell's television ministry.
In the few minutes that we have left here, one of the other trends that you noted in your paper, and again, we'll link to this. I recommend our listeners to go ahead and check out the paper that you have on the Art of Guiding series, because it was filling in a lot more things than we had here to talk about within an hour. But one of the interesting aspects I found near the end of your paper was about what is known as the most segregated hour in America, which is 11 o'clock Sunday morning. And this deals with the separation of whites into white churches, blacks into black churches. What's the trend line on that? Are things changing? Are they not changing? What are your prognostications on this?
My prognostication is that they're not going to change that much, but the lines at the boundaries are going to become quite fuzzy. Mm-hmm. The big move that has been made in the last generation has been a reconciliation between black leaders and white leaders at the highest levels. There has been some integration within denominations. The Methodist Church got rid of its segregated structures, and most of the other large denominations have welcomed African Americans into the highest level of leadership. And at those higher levels, integration has occurred. At the congregational level, because of the continued segregation within the country and blacks living in black communities and whites living in white communities, the segregation at the congregational level is going to continue. But white congregations are welcoming black members in, even valuing the few that they have. African Americans feel more at home in African American contexts in many cases, but you know, a small but growing number are finding their way to white churches that are closer to them, rather than black churches. But race continues to be a very, very important dividing line in America, the most important, apart from really speaking another language and not knowing English. That's the other segregating factor.
That's why I also wanted, we talk about black churches and white churches. What about the Latino community, which is growing rather rapidly and outpacing minority growth in most other areas? How have they been incorporated? And I guess we could also throw into the mix, too, being out here on the West Coast, we have a large Korean and Asian population. How are those groups getting integrated into our denominational structure?
The Asian groups are learning English rather rapidly and are being integrated rather rapidly. It's much easier to integrate Asians than it is African Americans. The Hispanic community is growing so rapidly, and Mexico is so close, that at least in this part of the country, that's Southern California, the barrier between those groups is going to remain for quite a while, and we're yet to see what's going to happen. Largest radio station in terms of listeners in Los Angeles now is Spanish-speaking. So Spanish is really establishing itself in Southern California, and church groups are the most conservative. Those barriers are going to remain, but it's also the case that a large percentage of the Spanish-speaking are already parts of English-speaking denominations. Assemblies of God, United Methodist, Roman Catholic, some Southern Baptist. So there's room for integration as they become bilingual and then English speaking, and it's, you can learn English, you can't learn white. So that's the real issue that we're facing.
Yeah, I guess the other thing you just mentioned a little bit in passing when we talked about the Latino communities, there's a popular impression that, you know, most of them tend to be Roman Catholics, and indeed a large portion are, but there's a significant movement, even, you know, by immigrants coming up into the United States and moving to Pentecostal churches, to Mormon churches, to Jehovah's Witnesses. Is that correct?
Well, there's a large number that are Church of God Cleveland and Assemblies of God, but as they're moving in, they're bringing with them all of the unique Mexican denominations and particularly the non-Trinitarian Pentecostal denominations are growing. So all of these Mexican groups are now getting established and are building denominational structures in Texas and California. So that's going to be a very, very important part of it. The one thing that works against them is the low density of population in Arizona and New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of them are moving on up into urban areas, which are dominantly English-speaking. And the pressure on Spanish-speaking people in Chicago, for example, is to learn English in one generation.
Right.
What they've got going for them is the continued influx of Spanish-speaking. I remember the lesson that from Bishop Asbury at the beginning of the Methodist Church. There was a move to merge the Methodist in southeastern Pennsylvania into the church. And Asbury said, no, there's no room for German-speaking folks in an English-speaking country. They got to learn English, and then we'll merge with them. Well, it took them 150 years to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
We only merged with the German Methodist in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
What he didn't realize was that Germans were going to continue to come into the country in large numbers through the 19th into the early 20th century. What we've got now is a long-term immigration set up with Spanish-speaking people, so that they will be able to sustain a Spanish-speaking culture for at least this coming century.
And I think that's the big theme that really comes out of your paper and your work is the denominational structure of the United States is always in constant flux, and sometimes it changes rapidly, other times it takes, as you say, 100, 150 years to really manifest these changes in its organizational form. But we'll keep our eye on these different changes, and we want to thank you for joining us on Research on Religion today, and I hope to speak with you in the near future. Thank you, Gordon.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.